Everyone, and welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Sisti. Major Crouch, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
I am.
And Major Wright, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Megan Crouch, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, we represent Staff Sergeant Daniel Sisti, the appellant in this case. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Air Force Court did not have the benefit of this court's decision in Harvey when it erroneously interpreted the factual sufficiency standard under Article 66 D1B. The Air Force Court's application of this erroneous standard requires remand for a new factual sufficiency review consistent with Harvey. But remand is not the only option. Alternatively, this court can conduct its own de novo legal and factual sufficiency review under Article 67C and set aside Sergeant Sisti's convictions. The lower court erred in applying the factual sufficiency standard in three ways. First, it misinterpreted the words appropriate deference and clearly convinced in the standard set out in Article 66. Second, it applied this erroneous standard during its factual sufficiency review. And third, it did not conduct its own new weighing of the evidence. The lower court misinterpreted the words appropriate deference to be a more deferential standard. It agreed with the Navy Marine Corps' conclusion that the words appropriate deference is a higher standard than the former version's de novo requirement. The Air Force Court adopted this conclusion and essentially concluded that this is a per se heightened deference across the board. The court then applied this standard to during its factual sufficiency review. The court also misinterpreted the words clearly convinced to be more than what this court set out in Harvey. The court said they must not only find the weight of the evidence does not support the conviction, but they must be clearly convinced this is the case.
Counsel, on the first part of this, So the standard is appropriate deference, and so you must be suggesting that the deference that the CCA gave the trial court was inappropriate. And in Harvey, we said that the CCA has discretion to determine what appropriate deference is and that we would review that determination for an abuse of discretion. So they would have to be wildly wrong, right, for their determination of how much deference was appropriate. Why – can you articulate why you believe that the level of deference that the CCA decided to give the court-martial in this instance was inappropriate, and so – and they were so wrong about that that they abused their discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. First, it was that the Air Force Court misinterpreted what the words appropriate deference mean because they interpret it to mean a blanket heightened deference. And the court went further than that in believing that it's not just an appropriate deference to the trial court's determinations regarding credibility of the witnesses and other evidence, but also adopted the principle that the court will weigh the evidence in a deferential manner to the result at trial. So then taking that misinterpretation and applying it to Sergeant Sisti's case during its factual sufficiency review, the court gave too much deference to the military judge, not only for the judge's weighing of the credibility of the complainant in this case, but then also to the verdict and findings, the military judge's findings at trial. When the court took the misinterpretation of the standard and applied it to Sergeant Sisti's case, the court operated under that more deferential, that umbrella of a more deferential standard.
Now, it's kind of hard to parse the deference they gave to the fact findings and the credibility determinations of the court-martial and what is, as I think you, in your words, their sort of ultimate findings.
Like, what do we look to in the CCA's opinion that tells us that they got that wrong, that they confused the deference they thought was appropriate for the fact that the court-martial saw the witnesses testify and made credibility determinations from their ultimate finding?
Yes, Your Honor. So first, at JA 193 to 194, the court said that they broadly agree with the Navy Marine Court's idea that appropriate deference is a more deferential standard. Additionally,
let's just start with that. What's wrong with that statement? So now, right, in conducting their factual sufficiency review, the CCAs are mandated to give appropriate deference to certain evidentiary findings of the court-martial. Right? So that's new, right? So why, just by definition, doesn't that cabin their discretion at least a little bit?
Your Honor, it's the fact that the Air Force Court adopted the Navy Marine Court's conclusion of this higher standard when they say that they broadly agree that the appropriate deference is a more deferential standard. And so then it's this blanket approach of they must give heightened deference to the trial court instead of assessing, depending upon the evidence, what is the degree of deference that the court should give. Because this court even said in Harvey that a CCA may determine that the weight of credibility or the degree of deference is low, depending upon the evidence, and that a CCA can actually weigh the evidence differently than the way that the trial court weighed it. So this idea that the per se heightened deference is what appropriate deference means, if that's the conclusion that the Air Force Court is going in with, then when they apply it to Sergeant Sisti's case, the court gave too much deference to the military judge, or at a minimum, this court can't know if the lower court would have given less deference if it believed that it could. And so taking that misinterpretation of appropriate deference and clearly convinced and applying it to Sergeant Sisti's case, the court gave too much deference not only to the trial court's weighing of the credibility of AH, but then also to the verdict at trial.
So I really want to understand, and I'm not trying to be argumentative, but is the crux of your argument that they excluded the possibility of giving no deference to the court-martial? That appropriate, like, I don't think there's anything we said in Harvey, or perhaps the phrase appropriate deference in the statute does not exclude zero deference. Is the crux of your argument that their statement and their opinion suggests that they excluded the possibility that they owed the court-martial zero deference because they said we owe them some, and some means not zero?
Your Honor, that's part of it. So it's part of the fact that they exclude the possibility of there being no deference, but more than that, that the court operated under this idea that they had to give a certain amount of deference, a heightened deference to the trial court, and did not have the, was essentially not allowed under the standard to give a low amount of deference or no deference to the trial court, not only to the determination of the credibility of witnesses, but also the findings, which is just wrong, because that's not what the standard sets out.
Major Crouch, can I ask you a question, and you can return to Judge Hardy's position here. How does one assess or measure degrees of deference? And I ask that just out of curiosity for myself, because we use this kind of language a lot, and we see it in statutes. But how do you assess that? How do you know that the court gave less deference, more deference? And how much deference do we give them? Less deference, more deference? How is it measured? I mean, it's an unfair question because you're probably in the same boat as I am, but I'll take your best shot here.
Your Honor,
I
think it is a difficult question to answer. And going forward,
Other than what they actually say in their opinion, but are they required to say it? And then if they don't say it, how do we then look and tell whether they gave less, more, medium? I'm not trying to jump on you. I really don't understand how you do it.
It's difficult, Your Honor, because this is a new statute, and this court and lower courts are interpreting it for the first time and trying to make sense of it. And it may not be enough for a lower court just to say, we affirm the findings of the sentence. We believe that, state the language that we believe the conviction is not against the weight of the evidence, and we affirm the findings of the sentence. Maybe a court has to say more, maybe not. And in this case, the problem is that the lower court did not have this court's decision in Harvey to understand how to interpret what Article 6061B says. And then additionally, when the court said that this appropriate deference is a more deferential standard, then going into its analysis, even though it says giving appropriate deference to the military judge, the problem is that appropriate deference, the court's interpretation of what that is wrong. And so its application of that standard is incorrect.
So from your perspective, does Harvey provide sufficient guidance to the court, or do we need to provide additional guidance?
Your Honor, it would be beneficial to provide a little bit of additional information.
And from your perspective, what additional guidance, information should we be providing to the lower courts?
Appropriate deference as used in Article 6061B is not a per se heightened deference to the trial court. When a lower court conducts a factual sufficiency review, it must conduct its own independent weighing of the evidence and give only the amount of deference it believes is appropriate to the trial court, to the fact that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses and other evidence.
So just to make sure I understand your point, are you saying that we need to clarify Harvey, or are you saying we need to emphasize what we've already stated in Harvey?
Both, Your Honor. To clarify that appropriate deference is not a per se heightened deference because...
So we did not make that clear enough in your perspective?
No, Your Honor. I think that the court can include that language to make it very clear that it's not a per se heightened deference, and then to also emphasize the new weighing of the evidence, because that's the other problem with the lower court's decision, is that the lower court did not conduct its own weighing of the evidence, and this court said in Harvey that a CCA must still do its own weighing of the evidence as part of its factual sufficiency review. In this case...
Can I switch your attention, as your time's running out, to Article 67C1C? As it's written, it's a little weird because it sounds like the findings set forth in the entry of judgment as affirmed, dismissed, set aside, or modified by the Court of Criminal Appeals as incorrect. Well, how would you affirm it as being incorrect? And I think both sides have suggested ways that words could be implied. And I wanted to ask about, when I read this, I had sort of a different view from the views that were expressed in both briefs. And it seemed like the words I thought would be implied would come right before the words as incorrect. And those words would be something like, after being challenged. So we could review the findings set forth in the entry of judgment as affirmed, dismissed, set aside, or modified by the Court of Criminal Appeals. Then my implied words, after being challenged, as incorrect in fact, under Section 866D1B. I mean, I think that would be the only way that something could be both affirmed or dismissed or set aside or modified. It's not referring to the Court of Criminal Appeals as saying it's incorrect, but that it was being challenged as being incorrect. Is that inconsistent with what you're arguing? Would that implied term be inconsistent with your position?
Your Honor, I'm not sure how the as challenged
or after being challenged, so that is to say, after being challenged at the CCA as being incorrect.
I'm not sure how that would then apply to the affirmed language.
Well, it would be affirmed after it was challenged. In other words, they challenged it, but the CCA affirmed it. You'd still be here.
Yes, Your Honor. That seems to still line up with what our position is that once a lower court has made a determination, has done a factual sufficiency review and made a determination as part of that factual sufficiency review.
And that would only occur if it's been challenged under the new law, because they don't do it sua sponte anymore.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that would line up with what our position is regarding Article 67.
Of course, that still doesn't get to the question of whether we can review the facts as opposed to just the law. Now, the government's position seems to be that we can review it just like we're doing now in terms of, did you follow the legal standards? Did you give appropriate deference? Did you apply a heightened standard or something like that? But we still can't review the facts. I mean, isn't that the way to reconcile the two conflicting provisions? We can review, but we can only make our decisions based on law. For example, we could say, you applied the wrong law, do it again, but we can't reweigh the facts without violating that other.
Your Honor, this court had the authority to do that before this change in Article 67. So Congress did not need to make a change in the law to have that be the outcome. But rather, Congress did make a change. The Congress did not go in and modify C1A. Instead, Congress changed and added in a new subsection to Article 67C. And Congress, this court assumes that Congress is aware of existing law when it passes legislation. And when Congress acts to amend a statute, courts presume it intended for the amendment to have real and substantial effect. And in the government.
So I understand your points. Perfectly valid points. What you're saying is you've got the new language in there that refers to findings. Congress inserted this new provision. They must have meant something by that. And you can use the canons of statutory interpretation in such a way that we could get to where you stand. But what we also have as a court is that bright red neon sign flashing in the night known as 67C4, saying we're only supposed to act when it comes to issues of law. So why wouldn't it be the judicially responsible thing, in light of the important fact that the Supreme Court has said that a court should not arrogate onto itself jurisdiction unless there's been a legislative grant, why should we not simply say, Congress, this is completely baffling. If you want us to exercise some additional authority, we will do it gladly. We are not trying to be obstructive here. But when we're faced with a situation where the language that you've had here is so befuddling that we don't know exactly what you're talking about, we don't even know remotely what you're talking about. So we're going to stand back. We're going to focus on 67C4, saying only in regard to law, and wait for DOD General Counsel and Congress to figure this out. Why would that not be the appropriate approach for this court to take?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I?
Please do. And there may be a number of other questions from the court here.
Yes, Your Honor. Because this court has said that Congress, you're going to go back to the same language, that this court has said that Congress intends to effect real change. So Congress intended for this court to do something different than what it's already doing. And if the court does decide to step back and not do anything with Article 67C1C, this court can still look to the lower court's erroneous interpretation application of Article 66D1B and remand the case for a new factual sufficiency review.
So, counsel, how would you then reconcile, and this is what the Chief Judge was getting at, how would you reconcile C1C with C4?
Your Honor, C1C is plain and unambiguous, and it is in conflict with C4. When looking at C1C in the entire statute, it is in conflict with C4. And so using the statutory canon of construction of the specific over the general, C1C is specific to this court about how it can act regarding a lower court's factual sufficiency rulings. Mm-hmm. And this court can view that specific direction as an exception to the general prohibition that the court can only act on matters of law.
Counsel, is that, I mean, you say it's specific. Is it really specific? It seems pretty ambiguous to me. I mean, the Congress just in their amendment to Article 66 in the new D1B, they gave us an example of how, if they want to be specific about how a court should do factual sufficiency, that's a great example. And even that's not that specific. But why would they not give us the same instructions if what they intended for us to do, and I think you argue this in your brief, that we should do exactly what the CCAs are doing under Harvey, right? So that would be importing all of Article 66 D1B into Article 67, not because Congress put it there, because we just sort of, well, we got to do something, so we might as well do that. So, like, that's specific language. Like, but we don't have anything like that in Article 67, even with this new amendment. So why wouldn't we stick, you know, I guess I don't really understand why you're saying the new Article 67 C, C1C language is so specific. It doesn't seem specific about doing factual sufficiency at all.
Your Honor, it may not be as specific as Article 66 D1B, but it is specific directing the court. It's the only place where in that statute it directs the court to act regarding factual sufficiency. And what I mean by that, Your Honor, is that it specifically uses the language under Section 866 D1B. So it isn't just like C1A where it says this court can act on findings affirmed or set aside as incorrect in law. It specifically directs the court to say findings affirmed, dismissed, set aside, or modified under Section 866. So it's specific about factual sufficiency and the lower court's ruling regarding factual sufficiency. And so
doesn't that argument actually undercut your point, which is that you said Congress must have added that provision for a reason, but the reason is, or the reason might be, that 866 D1B is a new provision, and this section now refers to that new provision. I mean, maybe that's the only reason that they amended it, not to give us new factual sufficiency review, but just to put a reference in 67 that now matches the amended 866, because D1B didn't exist as it was before. I mean, in other words, why would they amend it? The reason is because they amended 66 and they had to cross-reference. No substantive change intended.
Your Honor, looking at the prior Article 67, C1A never referenced Article 66 either. And this court still interpreted that it could review factual sufficiency rulings for correct legal principles. So again, Congress must have
isn't it possible then that Congress was just conforming Article 67 to the practice that this court had been doing, either justified or unjustified, for 25 years?
But Congress didn't need to do that because Article 67.
I mean, you might argue it's good practice. This court has assumed all kinds of authorities over its 7 decades that it may or may not have had. Maybe if Congress wanted us to actually have those authorities, especially in light of a more textualist court that looks at these questions more carefully, they thought, no, we really want you to review this.
Your Honor, if that's the position that the court takes, then again, I would direct the court back to the lower court's ruling and the fact that the lower court erred in its Article 66 D1B factual sufficiency determination. It's our position that that's not what Congress intended, and if that's the position that the court takes, then the Sergeant Sisti can still win regarding the lower court's errors in its factual sufficiency ruling.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Wright?
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Jocelyn Wright, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Congress gave this court oversight over the CCA's new factual sufficiency review, not authority to do its own. Only when the CCA and the fact finder disagree as to an appellant's guilt, can this court weigh in? Whether this court can conduct factual sufficiency review breaks down into two subtopics. First, what this court may act on, that's your statutory interpretation, and two, how the court can do so, the standard of review. So turning first to Article 67, C1C, it is ambiguous, as Your Honors pointed out. Using the grammatical structure within that subsection, as correct in fact, appears to modify all words in the series before it, which includes the word affirmed. How do we affirm as incorrect in fact? And so reading in an attempt to make sense of it, we look to the cross-reference in 66 D1B, where you have the available relief listed there by that the CCAs can provide when they have conducted their factual sufficiency review and deemed that the finding of guilty is against the weight of the evidence. There we find affirmed a lesser finding, meaning the lower court determined the greater offense was incorrect in fact, thus affirming instead the lesser included offense. That's the way that we determined to make that sentence structure make sense.
Wouldn't that fall under modified?
Your Honor, we try to give meaning to each word. It could fall under modified, but because they put the word affirmed a lesser finding, affirmed a lesser finding would be something like an LIO, the greater offense to the LIO, but modified would be something like removing the word diverse from a specification.
Can I ask about the suggestion that I gave appellant's counsel, which is if we read this to be right before it says as incorrect to include the words after being challenged, so it'd be the findings set forth in the judgment as affirmed, dismissed, set aside, or modified by the Court of Criminal Appeals after being challenged as incorrect, in fact, under 866. I mean, I think that would cover all of those terms because, I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about. Somebody, you have to now challenge it. It's not sua sponte, but after it's challenged under 866, then we could review that. Now, wouldn't be necessarily we could do factual sufficiency. We could determine whether it's factually sufficient, but we could still decide, did you apply Harvey right?
And this court could always determine.
Is that inconsistent with your view if we were to read it that way? Because appellant says it's not inconsistent with their view. It's not necessarily their view, but it's not inconsistent with their view.
It's consistent with, but more expansive, Your Honor, because our interpretation does not include factually sufficient findings. Our interpretation is that this court can only review factually insufficient determinations by the lower court.
Well, I mean, I think that would be, it was challenged as being factually insufficient, but it was affirmed they could still appeal. If it was reversed, well, maybe the government could appeal saying you didn't apply the right standards. Maybe the government can't appeal that, I don't know. It would be, it just seems really weird to have as incorrect modify all of those terms. Unless incorrect is modifying the fact that it was challenged as being incorrect.
And we agree, Your Honor, it is weird that this grammatical structure is not necessarily helpful to the court. The reason I'm hesitant to agree that it includes a challenge that's affirmed as ultimately factually sufficient is because of the legislative history, Your Honor. And I know typically we don't go to legislative history, but in this case...
But in this case, it was affirmed. They're challenging it. We're up here. Now, that doesn't mean we can do anything more than act on questions of law, but, I mean, are you suggesting we shouldn't even be here?
No, Your Honor. We believe that this new addition to the statute is parallel to the overhaul of 66's factual sufficiency review and allows this court to provide oversight. Now, it's new and has to be given meaning. If this court is just looking at legal errors, which is required by C4, This court can only act on matters of law. There has to be something new about this statute, or this portion of the statute, excuse me. So we believe, based on the legislative history, that this is an opportunity for the court to make sure that the lower court did not abuse their discretion and appropriately weighed the evidence, not conducting its own factual sufficiency review, but essentially acting as oversight on how the lower court weighed the facts. Now, this court has never been permitted to do that before, and it certainly has never been able to do its own factual sufficiency review. We're not going so far as to say that.
So I just want to be sure that I understand your point, and I think this goes to a point that Judge Maggs was making. Here, in your briefs at least, you're talking about we would have review if there was a determination of legal insufficiency below. Here, in this case, they found it was legally sufficient. So are you saying we should not even be reviewing that aspect of this case?
Correct, Your Honor.
So if that's the case, why do we need to wade in at all on this at this point? Why shouldn't we, going back to my questioning of Major Crouch, say, this is mystifying. What Congress has done here is absolutely mystifying. Even with the government's interpretation that says that we only have legal insufficiency review, we don't have to lock that in now. We can simply say, we don't know what Congress intended. We're going to go back to first principles of we don't, as a court, arrogate onto ourselves jurisdiction that is not clearly provided to us by the legislature.
Counsel, before you answer, I just want to, Chief, you said legally insufficient. Did you mean factually insufficient?
No.
Oh, okay.
Because it's counsel's point that we only have legal insufficiency review.
So, Your Honor, I would direct you to the legislative history in this case, because both the House and the Senate determined that there needed to be some kind of review when the lower court, the CCA, made a determination that they were clearly convinced the finding was against the weight of the evidence, which would be that the finding is factually insufficient. The House proposed that the CCA do an en banc review any time they wanted to overturn a conviction for factual insufficiency. The Senate proposed instead this court do so, which is where we're getting a large part of our influence in this argument, because Congress is saying we want this court to act as oversight for this new discretionary factual sufficiency review the lower court can do. And if this court were just to say,
well, but just, I'll have a question, but finish your thought. I'll come back.
Your Honor, I lost my train.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's my fault. So you mentioned the new discretionary review that the CCA is doing. So certainly appellants arguing that their factual sufficiency, the court below erred by believing that its factual sufficiency review had been constrained. Do you agree that it's been constrained, or do you think it's of a different? You just said it was new, so I'm curious how the government believes it's new now under the new Article 66.
How the factual sufficiency
yes.
review is new? It's discretionary now, Your Honor. So under Thompson, Peace, and Washington, it was mandatory before.
You just mean that like there's this now triggering. The Article 66 includes this triggering provision that it has to be challenged, and there's a prima facie case, so they don't call it that. And okay, so that's the aspect in the government's view that's new.
Yes, Your Honor. And the fact that there is a may in whether or not the CCA can decide to actually take it, even if the two triggers are met, there's still a question about whether or not the CCA can decide not to review for factual sufficiency, even though those triggers have been met, because there is a may in that sentence. This court in Harvey, and in this case here, no one is challenging that those triggers were met, so it's not ripe at this point in this case. But that discretionary aspect, whether or not they conducted the factual sufficiency review, makes it discretionary as well. Then an additional level of discretion, the CCA gets to decide whether or not the it's factually insufficient because the finding of guilt was against the weight of the evidence. And then they get to decide, they have discretion to decide what the appropriate relief in that situation would be. So 66 now has built in a good deal more discretion for the lower court.
Now, and this is something one thing you skipped over, and I don't think you did intentionally, was that there is this caveat to what the CCAs are supposed to do in factual sufficiency, that they have to give appropriate deference to various things that the court-martial does. How does that, you know, and that's a big part of the appellant's argument as to what the CCA did wrong here, that whatever appropriate deference means, they didn't give it, or, you know, they didn't understand, they were too, felt overly constrained. What is the government's response to that? What is the government's view of what are the limits on appropriate deference that the CCA has to give to various evidentiary findings of the court-martial?
I think this court in Harvey got it right in that it's based on the evidence itself. I mean, if you have the type of evidence could change how much deference you give to the lower court, whether the CCA could view it themselves. For example, video recordings or audio recordings. The court heard them in largely the same format that the lower court would have seen or heard them. The credibility question, you know, how much deference to give to the lower court, that's where you could differ much more, potentially. But I think this court got it right and doesn't need to expand the test because it said it's based on the evidence in the case. And the lower court here said specifically that the significance of the credibility of particular witnesses or testimony will vary depending on the circumstances of the case. So it aligns with this court's proposition in Harvey, even though they didn't have the benefit of that case, that it is a case-by-case analysis. They could give more deference, they could give less deference. It's ultimately up to them. And they didn't explicitly say, we are giving a super high amount of deference to the lower court or a really low amount of deference. They didn't make a bright line rule in this case. The question of credibility of the victim in this case was an issue. There's a long footnote about the facts surrounding her credibility. So they do discuss credibility in here, but ultimately that was not the most critical evidence that the court found. The most critical evidence in this case were the statements, the recorded statements from the accused. So they mention credibility and that it's a case-by-case analysis, but they didn't create a bright-line rule.
Does the government agree that appropriate deference may mean no deference? Does the scale go from none to something very, very high in the government's view, depending on the kind of evidence and other factors?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it really does depend on the case. I mean, you could have situations with a great deal of evidence and one particular piece maybe isn't as vital as other portions, or you could have a case with just one witness's testimony, which the law says is enough. But, you know, there could be levels of deference, and we would agree the spectrum is quite wide.
And do you have a response to the appellant's argument that they argue that the CCA did not understand or did not realize without the benefit of Harvey that appropriate deference might mean no deference? Do you read the CCA's opinion the same way, or do you have a different understanding?
We don't read the opinion as the CCA saying they could never give deference to the court. They were very focused on this particular case and didn't articulate anything that would signal that they didn't think they could ever, not ignore the lower court, but give no deference to the lower court. They were focused on the issues in this case and credibility and evaluating the evidence. It was not a long opinion with regard to the weighing of the evidence portion, but it doesn't need to be. They essentially hit the highlights of the lower court's decision and then moved to other portions of the case.
Now, Judge Sparks pointed out earlier that it's really hard to, like there's all these standards of review and appropriate deference, and what does that mean? Is there any requirement that the CCA walk through, like, we are giving this evidence, this deference, and this evidence, this deference, and then we're going to weigh all this evidence? Like, how much explanation is the CCA mandated to put into their opinion, in the government's view, in order to sustain, you know, not have us to overturn them?
There's no requirement, Your Honor, that they write out a lengthy opinion. Anything, I mean, this court in Gwynn and Matthias have said that one sentence is sufficient to say, you know, we affirm for the following reason. So I don't think we need to have a mandate of how much they should say. It's still an abuse of discretion review. If this court, in looking at it, determines some kind of deference standard, like when a military judge does a 403 balancing test, they are reviewed for an abuse of discretion. They get additional deference if they show their work, essentially. That could be what this court could do in reviewing it, but it's not an error that deserves
remand. So we'd have a sliding scale on top of a sliding scale?
It's just a suggestion, Your Honor. I don't know. I don't know what a good answer is. I'm just providing an option for the court.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but bootstrapping off that, appellant argues that the court needs to revisit Harvey in the sense of either providing clarification or amplification. Is that the government's position? Do we need to revisit Harvey?
Harvey is seems to be well written in the government's perspective in that it's clear that the court, the lower court, has deference to check, has discretion to check the lower court. And it says it's a case-by-case endeavor. And it's kind of a totality of the circumstances type analysis where you're looking at all of their work, basically. But I don't think this court needs to make a bright-line rule. I think it's fairly clear from the decision in Harvey that it depends on the actual evidence provided at the lower court level, at the trial court level.
Counsel, I have one more question. So appellant's counsel argued that one way we could know that the CCA was mistaken or confused about the law in this case was that they described the new standard under Article 66 as more deferential than the old standard. Does the government agree that that's a misstatement of the law, or do you have a different view?
I don't know that it's a misstatement of the law, Your Honor. I think it's a commentary on the change, but I don't believe they were making a bright-line rule saying it's always a more deferential or a higher standard looking at the military judge or the fact finder generally and their ultimate determinations. So I don't think the court was saying that. They were saying we agree broadly with the Navy Marine Corps that the credibility portion, we can still look at credibility of witnesses and give appropriate deference to the lower court. But I don't think they were saying it must be higher always. Because immediately after those statements in the following paragraphs, they start discussing that credibility is a case-by-case determination. It depends on the circumstances of the case. One final point I would like to make is that this court cannot engage in its own factual sufficiency review without explicit authorization from Congress or somewhere in the Constitution, as we've discussed previously. And this is not some kind of an exception to C-4, because if it were an exception to C-4, that would be a huge unprecedented grant of authority by implication to this court. This is not a subsection under C-4 that would indicate it's somehow an exception, and Congress didn't use the word except their new edition under C-1C. Barring any additional questions?
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Wright.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Crouch.
By the Air Force Court's own assessment, this case was a close call. Those are the words that they used. It was a close call regarding the factual sufficiency review. They go on to say then that under the new standard, indicating that it is but for this new standard that the court may have come to a different conclusion. This court said that the degree of deference, in Harvey, the degree of deference will depend on the nature of the evidence at issue. And what the Air Force Court said is that the significance of credibility of particular witnesses or testimony will vary depending upon the circumstances of the case. Those are not the same. So the Air Force Court agreed with the Navy Marine Court's interpretation that it is a higher standard, and then said that the significance of credibility will vary depending on the circumstances of the case. But that's not that the degree of deference will depend on the evidence in the case. So the Air Force Court got the appropriate deference standard wrong, and it's not in line with Harvey. By applying the wrong standard, the court affirmed an unjust conviction, and Sergeant Sisti did not get a proper Article 66 review. This court has said that even though a lower court is not required to identify the basis for its action, failure to do so makes it difficult to determine whether a lower court's exercise of its Article 66 power was made based on a correct view of the law. So even the government agrees that this opinion is lacking in what it in its analysis. Certainly the court misinterpreted the standard, but then it did not provide much analysis about how it was applying that erroneous standard, and then did not conduct its own weighing of the evidence.
So in your perspective, to what extent does a lower court need to explain its analysis?
Your Honor, it may not need to do so going forward. However, in this case, because it used the wrong standard, this court can know that it applied that erroneous standard. And if the lower courts are going to say anything, then it needs to be correct. And that's not what happened in this case. So going forward, it's possible that a lower court may not need to say as much. However, this court decided in this case, on a case of first impression, that it was going to provide an analysis about its interpretation of Article 66, which it got wrong, and then it was going to apply that erroneous standard to its factual sufficiency review. It did not conduct its own weighing of the evidence, and Sergeant Sisti did not get a proper Article 66 review. The court affirmed an unjust conviction, and this court should remand for a new factual sufficiency review. Pending any further questions?
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Crouch.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
Court stands in recess until 10:30.